No!
No! No!
What?
Because I was married for 2 fucking years!
You're a cunt, Ryan.
Fuck you, Carmen.
You're a cunt, Ryan.
No, sir, I don't like it. No, sir, I don't like it.
Fuck you, Carmen.
You're a cunt, Ryan.
No, sir, I don't like it.
Sure. Because they were like, this is bullshit and it's just reverse racism. I was like, well, it's a little more complex than that.
Yeah.
I said, it's just the stuff that we don't normally think about. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of it, they went, okay, I guess we can see that. They're like, but a lot of people are misusing that term. And I went, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, without question. Because, yeah, it's just two words. It's easy to just throw at anything.
Yeah.
Like, well, I dare you to find any term people aren't misusing.
Sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, once you use it, then you overuse it, right?
Yeah, right.
Just to show people that you know the word and that you know how to use it.
Somebody pulled up like to Starbucks and they were in this like amazing, just slick Escalade, mm-hmm, with, you know, tinted windows and amazing rims. And the dude in front of me at Starbucks looks at his friend, they look out the window, and they just go, white privilege. And
what?
I was like,
what?
And it's not my place to step in and go, yeah, guys, that's not what white privilege is. It's not the
idea.
It's
not the ability
he,
to buy an Escalade.
Bought a nice car.
Yeah. That's...
And by the way, we don't even know who's driving the car.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, people misuse the term. But anyway, my point was, so she sat down, Betsy McIntosh, Betsy or Betty, I can't remember. She made this list, and it was what we're talking about. But there could be benefit to other races sitting down going, I wonder how I benefit that I'm unaware of.
For sure.
Yep.
And well, there's a lot of talk
wants
of that
to do it because we're in like a victim culture
now. Right.
So it's much better to sit down and make a list of how you're not winning.
Yes.
Right.
And of course, we've got a whole swath of white people going, well, here's how we're not winning.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to make that list.
Everybody's
and it's really it's mm-hmm. really messed up because people in their lists are wild right now.
For sure.
Yeah. they don't want they
well, there's
don't
a lot of that going
sides.
On in the Hispanic community about because there's already racism within it, like light Hispanic, like white passing Hispanics, black Hispanics, all of that stuff, like all that's happening.
Right.
And so well, that's all
I
the
grew
conversation
up in El Paso, mm-hmm. So I grew up right on the border, and the idea that if you speak a certain type of Spanish to somebody else,
mm-hmm,
like the higher class Spanish, if
yep.
you speak like you're speaking down to them.
And like yeah. if you do like the Barcelona lift.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because like, that's how I learned Spanish is Spain Spanish.
Yeah.
And it's like, how am I supposed to just know your dialect? How I'm being a dick just because I'm talking to you in the only dialect of a language that we both know.
Yeah. And right. if in English, like when I was living in Georgia, if somebody from fucking somewhere else came up to me and started using a Southern accent just to relate to me, I'd punch him in the face. Like, that's fucking insane.
Exactly. That's
Don't
even more insulting.
Dialect.
Yeah.
He's like, we're in the South. We can refer to black men as boy.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, no, buddy. No,
no
we
that's
can't.
Not,
that's not
no,
how
no,
that
no,
works
no,
at all.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Georgia from Maine, all right? Don't talk to me like that.
There is one thing about the whole white privilege thing that upsets me greatly,
mm-hmm,
and because I'm a stand-up comic. Mm-hmm. See, in the 1980s, there were a lot of comics getting on stage, and, you know, since stand-up was still new and there were mm-hmm. so many people doing it,
yeah,
there was a lot of hackery.
The boom, baby.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and because the demand for stand-up was so high, they needed supply.
Yeah, now
so they
people
were like,
don't
hey,
want it.
Can you
so
do
much.
Five? Get on stage.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so every dummy got on stage, and there were a lot of bland observations that a lot of people had, and they just got repeated.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And one of them was, and it could be any comic on stage, black, white, Hispanic, whoever, and they would look out at the crowd and they go, have you seen these flesh colored band-aids? Who are these for?
Yeah.
And
yep.
that was kind of the end of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go, look at you, black guy, it doesn't work for you. I'm white and it doesn't work for me. Look at you, person, it mm-hmm. doesn't work for you. Who are these for? And the whole audience would laugh and clap.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like, yes, we're all in this together. We're mm-hmm. unified.
Yeah.
It's humans versus the band-aid company that can't get it right.
Yeah.
And then one of the elements on Betsy McIntosh's list of white privilege is when you go to buy Band-Aids, they more or less match your skin color. That's one of the things on her list. And people nodded their heads and went, yeah, that's right. That's one of the ways that white people have it better. Now, if you think about that, that's a very divisive thing.
Yeah.
Instead yep. of bringing people together, humanity versus Band-Aids, she's taken the position oh no, white people have it better and then others have it worse. And you go, wow, what a weird way to divide things. And what even pisses me off more is she came up with that in 1988. So comedians had already been doing this joke all over the country and Americans already
That
agreed.
Might even be where she got it. Yeah. She might have seen it at a comedy club.
And then she's like,
and then
no.
she was like, you know what? It does match my skin.
I'm gonna put a twist on this and divide up people.
Yeah, I'm less mad at her and more mad at just that herd mentality where just one person tells them something. They're like, oh, yeah, that's it. And then somebody tells them the exact opposite. And they're like, oh, you're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They'll just believe
it's
anything.
Everybody nodding their heads yes at every bit of information, no matter how contradictory.
Even if it's conflicting.
Yeah, which I do feel like is the opposite of how comedy is now. Because comedy now, you go up in front of an audience, you say any opinion, they're immediately tightened up and are like, no, I'm not. I don't agree with you at all.
Right.
It's the exact
opposite. I don't know. I haven't done enough research to know if I'm allowed to laugh at that.
Yeah. Well, I remember 2004, I was living in the Bay Area. I was in San Francisco doing stand-up, and the number of comedians who would come and get on stage and be like, fuck George Bush, and the audience would erupt into applause. Mm-hmm. And
good
now,
joke.
Now, if you're in the Bay Area,
you can't do either one.
If
you can't
you
say
on stage,
fuck Trump
like,
or
fuck
the other
Trump,
one.
The liberal audience tenses up because they're like, conservative people might be here. And they deserve to like comedy as well. And you got no, what is going on?
Yeah.
You've cannibalized your own party.
There's no worse place. I just went up there and did a week-long run of shows. And I've been out of the Bay Area for 3 or 4 years now.
Yeah.
And it's 10 times worse than it was before. And it's just like, there's no point. That was like my sets always devolved into, there's no point in doing this. Why am I fucking here? Why are you here? Just these breakdowns.
And then they were like, oh, okay. Yeah. He had to lose his mind in order for them to be like, oh, it is all right for us to laugh.
Yeah. Well, people have accused me of being like this American psycho shock comic.
Sure.
Because I will talk about certain subjects that people find... I don't know, off-putting or taboo. Mm-hmm.
I can't relate to that at all.
But but they don't realize that it grew out of starting in the Bay Area where you knew whatever you were going to say was going to upset people.
Yep.
So what I would do is I would
might
make
as well
sure
talk about whatever you want.
The setup to the joke, the setup was going to be disgusting and shocking and make them upset, and then the punchline would make everything better.
Yep. Yeah, it's also creating suspense for the punchline. Right. It's a bigger release.
Right. People
it's
like just, movies
it's
like
the
that.
The exact same thing as just normal joke writing, but to toy with that audience of people that I was given who were so sensitive, like it shaped who I became as a comic. And now you've got liberal people who are like, yeah, but you really shouldn't talk about that stuff on stage because it's divisive. You're talking about things that people don't like abortion and rape and things, and we don't care for it.
Oh my God!
And you go, it's that mindset that created this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
You hate the fact that I grew out of that mindset.
You know what's funny about starting in the Bay Area is that I started at Brainwash, which recently closed, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes. Very sad. I my jaw fell open when I saw that posted on Louis Katz's Twitter feed.
Yep. It was an 18-year-long open mic in a laundromat.
So many people got their first set there. So Brent Weinbach got up there first.
Dude, I was talking to Joe Bartnick, who's like 14 years older than me, and I started old already at comedy, and his first set was there.
Oh, my God. I did not know that his first set was there.
Yeah, and a lot of other people he was naming all started there, because I think it was started in 1997 or 1998, something like that. But I was going to say about Brainwash, though, is it was in a rougher neighborhood in San Francisco, and the comics there went. I mean, it was like it was just like anywhere else. It was a really open-minded kind of vulgar, rough, friendly, like rough joke, rough material friendly room. And then you start getting booked, and you start doing real San Francisco crowds, and you've learned how to do comedy for psychos.
You move north in the peninsula.
Yeah. And you're like, what's going on?
Whoa.
This has always worked. Why are they looking at me like this?
So the Brainwash Cafe, it was, number one, it was like a little San Francisco cafe. Uh-huh. There's art on the walls, and there's... graffiti in the bathroom that is a little higher class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of Bukowski quotes.
Yeah, they paid for the graffiti. Right.
They really did. It's tiled. There's tiles with quotes of like Bukowski and Kerouac on it.
Yeah.
And then it's not just a cafe. Like, you can get coffee there, but you can get beer there as well. They have alcohol. Mm-hmm. But in the back is a laundromat. So people are doing their laundry, and there is no more miserable place. Like, people hate
doing laundry,
having to stand around in public doing their laundry,
listening to a comic do comedy for the first time, 18 of them in a row.
Right. And also,
so it was just a way to torture people even more doing the thing they hated the most. Like, I mean, the cafe makes sense because it's like, oh, you don't want to do your laundry. You can pretend you're working on your novel or whatever while you're here in between loads. But instead, we're going to bombard you with the fresh new thoughts of somebody who doesn't know how to do this art form while you're already upset because you're waiting for your laundry to finish. Right. Really beautiful business model.
And comedy was only on Thursdays. So they were being tortured with bad live music other days of the week.
Oh, nice.
Like, oh, yeah. No.
Slam poetry, I'm certain.
Sure. And the brainwash is like, no, but it's an art community. It's San Francisco. Get over it.
Yeah.
Sure enough, people came and sat and watched.
Yes.
But when you move north on the peninsula, where people are no longer in that stress factor.
Trapped?
Of like, all right, my
when they're no longer
my dryer's done in 15 minutes, so I'm going to have to do this. Like, their attitudes about what they were willing to listen to changed drastically.
Yeah.
I think one of the first bookings I ever had was at Cinecave.
Okay.
Which is below a video rental store. Very ultra hip crowd, and they were not down, and I didn't know what to do. Because I was doing stuff that was working at Brainwash.
Your Selma jokes
Eagle.
And shit like
that. You know, I was doing the Eagle, which is like a leather bar.
Okay.
You know, like a gay leather bar, which was down for gnarly. Everything I did was in South of Market.
Yeah.
And then, like, I get to the Mission and to Cinecave in a very hip crowd, and it was like, oh, I didn't even know that people were sensitive like
this.
And then it's all of them. They're all like this.
Right.
I went in front of the 0.5% of San Francisco that isn't like this and learned how to do comedy.
Yeah. And I think there is some value to that as far as that particular part of the country, because you do go across the bridge to Oakland, and then you've got 19-year-old Ryan Stout wearing a suit in front of a all black
crowd. So you've always worn a suit?
I didn't start wearing the suit until 2004, so probably I was still only like... I was like 21 when I started wearing a suit. So still, I looked like a boy in a suit.
And you're doing like Oakland rooms.
And I'm doing Oakland rooms where, you know, if you don't take charge of the room, you are dead.
Alive.
You're dead. And comics were always amazed that I could get up in those rooms and just condescend to the crowd. And the crowd loved it, and they were like, well, yes, this is what we expect out of you.
This is what we think a white guy is like.
You're a white man in a suit.
Yes. And you're the man, and the man is acting the way that I think the man should. And attaboy.
And jokes that would work there that would work, they didn't work anywhere else, and they especially didn't work in front of white people, because white people are like, you're being racist. And I'm like, no, I'm doing what the people of Oakland have
validated.
Proven that they expect out of me.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, they're going to be offended by that. I'm like, I know for a fact they aren't.
Yeah.
They know that I'm joking. One of my favorite jokes that I can't do anymore, which is I would get on stage and I'd be like, listen, white people would love to be black. We would love to be black. I'd like to be hip. I'd like to have rhythm. I'd like to say things like it's all gravy and have it refer to something other than gravy. I would love that. But listen, someone has to be in charge. Look, you can't just stop oppressing. This is a 24/7 thing, everybody. We have our meetings every week at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And we just think about how do we oppress. We just lay it out with a PowerPoint. And black audiences would laugh and clap and go, yes, of course.
Yeah, well, you're doing a white minstrel show.
Yeah.
You were in white face.
That's, you know what? We're bringing it back. And that's the title of the album, everybody. Yeah. White Minstrel Show.
Yeah, you're in whiteface.
Oh, my God. White man in whiteface. That is, we've gotten into a real meta level of comedy right now.
We should introduce you. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, by the way, to episode 60.
We're actually just about done, everybody.
We're about to wrap it up.
I'm sorry. You go on with the intro. I'm not going to ruin it.
Welcome to No Sir, I Don't Like It. Carmen Morales here with me, as always, the very funny Brian Vokey.
Hello.
And today we have a wonderful guest, Mr. Ryan Stout.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a new album out. It's called How to Be an Audience. So if you want to go check that out.
It's not a joke. That's the name of his album. It's really good.
I think about it all the time. I mean, that's my obsession. There's nothing I hate more than audiences right now.
It's a pearl white cover with a giant pig on it. So if you want to know... if there's any symbolism.
Is there lipstick on the
with
pig?
How I considered it.
You did.
I did. Yeah, but yeah. I thought that would be like pushing it
too much.
A little too far. Yeah. A little too,
far. Little too nail on the head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was going to give the pig a plate of nachos, but yeah, so I always encourage people to check that out because it's my second album and I released it on my own.
Nice. Good for you. I didn't realize that. That's badass.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
So what's the format? Like when you go to a show, do you have the cards or are you selling CDs? Did you do vinyl?
It's just digital.
Just digital.
Yeah.
Attaboy. Yeah, then you don't have to carry shit.
I've got the first CD and I was going to like places like San Francisco probably in like 2014 and they were saying things like, we don't have a CD player. We don't have anything that will play a CD. Mm-hmm. And that was 2014.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay, that makes sense. But now I'm going to places like the outskirts of Cincinnati, St. Louis, and poor people.
You don't have
going,
any CDs?
Yeah. We don't have anything that plays a CD. We don't even have a CD player in our car. I was like, wow, your car is newer than my car.
Right? Yeah.
And you're poor. Maybe this is why you're poor. We thought about your spending habits.
I thought you were about to go self-deprecating on that. You definitely turned around.
Yeah. I'm not wrong. I'm never wrong. The audience is wrong. Let me tell you how to be an audience.
Where did you record it?
Minneapolis at Acme.
Oh, such a great club.
What were you going to ask?
I was going to ask you if in the album you tell the audience how to be one.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I was recording.
Because you know, like sometimes titles don't have anything to do with the act, but something that's specific made me curious.
Sure. No, I've crafted a lot of jokes where the audience, at the punchline, the audience will moan, and they moan every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get to ask them, why would you moan at that? There was nothing in the joke that was moan worthy.
Yep.
And then they will come to the realization of like, wow, he's right. And they'll start to laugh and we'll continue with the show and then they'll do it again.
Yeah.
They'll do it again. I will do some sort of joke about a topic that they'll go, oh, that's not right. And then I'll do a joke right after that, right afterward. Same topic, and they'll laugh and clap. I'm like, how are you laughing and clapping now, but before? How does this even work, everybody?
Yeah.
And I told them, I'm like, I'm going to record these shows, and I'm going to put out a CD and call it How to Be an Audience, because you people need to learn.
Yeah.
And sure enough, like you can hear it on the album. Mm-hmm. So many people, I think there's some controversy about this when they release a comedy album. Some people want the audience to scream and yell like, this is an event and we're here for you.
Right.
And some people are like me where they're like, no, I want it to be absolutely
legit,
real. Mm-hmm. These people don't know we're recording. This is an audience full of strangers and I'm going to take them from 0 to 10 and then I'm going to say goodnight.
Yeah.
Whereas other albums, they're almost boring because they say, mm-hmm. please welcome famous person and people scream and clap.
Yeah.
And the audience is at a 10.
They open at 10 and you just have to maintain it.
They drop to 8 in mm-hmm. the middle. Because they're tired. And then they go to 10 at the end, mm-hmm. and then it's over. And you go, yeah, that was not a journey.
Yeah.
That was not a journey at all. So this audience, like, I berate them from the top. Because they barely clapped when I came to the stage. And I've actually got the MC on there going, are you guys ready for your headliner? Oh, Jesus Christ, everybody. Come on. This is what you came here for. Are you ready for your headliner? And then the audience claps, and then I yell at them for their lack of energy.
Yeah.
And that's how we start.
That's fun.
And then
which is a more real experience than it is for...
Yeah.
Because most of your sets are like... What the guy? I can't tell you how many sets I've started with. Come on. Nope. You're not doing this. Clap. You're at a show. Don't be a piece of shit. Come on. Let's do this. Like, I have to tell them.
Yeah. Dude, you need to do a third album called How to Be a Comedian because I have all these same problems, but it doesn't go so well for me. It's just they could feel the hate too much.
Before I released the album, I wrote a blog on my website, ryanstout.com. That was a good plug. And
subtle.
I thought that would be the snarky negative review from reviewers. This album should have been called How to Be a Comedian because it's not very funny.
Ooh.
But I wanted to write the blog first just so I could say, see, your opinion is hacky.
Yeah.
That's what a bad audience member you are, that I knew what you were going to say before you even said it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I meant it sincerely.
Oh, I know. You want training.
I want training on, because it sounds like you're very good at just turning your contempt into laughter. Yeah. Where I like, I get so mad at audiences lately where I'm like, I don't want you to like me. I don't want you to laugh. And then I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. I just right. like, I'm just combative.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of what I was doing, but I recognize what I was doing, which is I wasn't just yelling at the audience. I was yelling at my father. So maybe think about that.
Now I got a good relationship with him.
But the question is, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? Like, I have a great relationship with my dad. He's a sweetheart of a man.
Yeah.
But if I told him, Dad, I'm going to be an astronaut, he would look up from his newspaper and go, great. And if I said, I'm going to be a comedian, he'd go, good for you.
Right.
And it's like, look, this seems very supportive, but when do you get out of your chair and hug me? Like,
have you ever worked with a comedian named John Conroy? He has one of my favorite bits about this where it's like they say in sports, one of the hardest things to do is throw a football. But I think it's making your father love you, which really just sums up all that. Please.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it's so weird because I was confused about it because, again, my dad was always such a sweetheart of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he supports me. He likes me
for sure.
But my therapist was like, yes, but if you told your dad I'm going into battle, he's not going to say, OK, let me grab my sword.
Right.
And that's the pain.
Yeah.
The pain is he's not really following you.
Mm-hmm.
He's letting you go.
Right.
And you go, well, how does this relationship work? And then I watch him talk to his dad and I'm like, oh, you guys don't have a relationship either.
Yeah. You're just mimicking
your father's fault.
Mm-hmm. It's a long line of acquaintances.
He didn't know how
Yeah.
Which is kind of men in America.
Yeah.
It's a long,
your
long
mother
line
raised you. I'm just here to help.
I went to work for 12 hours. What the fuck do you want from me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I worked in the clock factory. What do you need?
Yeah.
A lot of my, close time with my father when I was a kid was just rubbing his shoulders. When he came from work, he'd be like, I'll give you a nickel to squeeze my shoulders because he just wanted a massage. That's not really a hug, is it?
No.
Nope. Child labor.
Yeah.
Dude, cheap child labor.
My father, this is a little too much, but he loves to get his toes pulled, and I would never do it, like crack his knuckles on his toe mm-hmm. knuckles. I would never do it. But he fucking paid a kid at his granddaughter's birthday party to pull his toes for him at a birthday party. Just some stranger 7-year-old.
Come on.
I'll give you a quarter to pull my toes. And then he's just got a kid pulling his toes. I was like, this isn't the 50s, dude. You can't have other people's kids touching your feet anymore.
Listen, I think a kid can consent to touch a foot. I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that a kid is allowed, and I'm going to say
that. Well,
it's
different from pulling toes, and it's like, tickle me. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's a very big, there's not a genre, subgenre of fucking.
sure.
Where you're getting off on your knuckles cracking.
Uh-huh. Well, if you could pay a kid to scratch your head, that doesn't seem such a bad thing, right?
No, yeah.
And the toes are just the opposite side. Genitals are in the middle. Genitals are in the middle.
Yeah.
No middle touching.
You're far
no ribs.
Away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember at a wedding, my nephew, he ended up, I mean, he was a small child, but he crawled under the bridesmaid's table, and then you just heard one of them scream, and he was just rubbing his hand along her soft leg that she had shaved, and, you know, he's just a kid.
He's a tactile kid.
Yeah.
He's just on
That's
his hands
me,
and
dude.
He's
I
crawling
touch
around.
All
the, and
I
then
touch everything.
Oh, you're soft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure if you're a lady in a dress sitting at a table, you don't expect somebody touching your leg out of nowhere.
Nope.
Yeah. Mm. It's like when a fish brushes against you and you're in a lake. You go, what was that?
Yeah, exactly.
The worst case scenario.
I did that. Actually, now that you mentioned that, that just triggered a memory that I had where I was at this bar with my parents called Rosie O'Grady's, where they would like do, it was like old vaudeville show that was like the thing that they did. And like all the servers and stuff were dressed up in fishnets and like the whole nine. And I remember it was the first time I'd ever seen a woman in fishnets. And I immediately was just doing the same thing, touching her leg. And she was just like, what are you doing? And I was like, this feels cool. Like that was, it was no idea that I was invading somebody's personal space or anything. I was just like, I never seen that. And what does that feel like? And it was totally that simple.
And if it were a different time, you could have just looked at her and said, no, I have autism. This is fine.
Yeah.
I'm a victim of a different brain chemistry, so mm-hmm. I get to touch.
Yeah.
I get to touch.
You just have to deal with this now.
Yeah, take it.
Dude, that shit gets extreme, though. I was a preschool teacher in San Francisco and in the Excelsior, and there was a lot of tactile-style kids, and there was this one girl who would just sit on the heel of her shoe and just rub her crotch on a heel of her shoe all day.
Wow.
And then she, at one point, we found her on the playground. The playground was framed with wood, and she was just rubbing her crotch. Just she's like scraped her whole every her thighs and everything on wood. She was just rubbing it.
Wow,
wow,
it was pretty intense, dude.
I had a friend who, she was teaching. Must have been kindergarten, first grade, or something like that. And there was a little girl on the playground who would like touch herself and bring herself to climax, yep, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And this teacher's like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is San Francisco. We're pro sexuality.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't want to stifle anything.
Uh huh.
But at the same time, we're like, there are public decorum type things.
Yeah.
We're not sure what to do in this situation. So she just asked the little girl, hey, why do you do that? And the little girl responded, because it makes me feel like a princess.
What a hell of a response. And, Jesus.
And my friend was like, yeah, I'm just going to let her do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who am I to deny somebody from feeling like a princess?
We would always say, like, look, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, but that's a nap time activity. That's what we would say. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with what you're doing, but it's like a nap time activity. Just like you don't eat on the playground. There's stuff... Yeah, you know, the playground is for
that makes sense. Good. Yeah.
You compared it to a biological function, mm-hmm, too. So that's that's good wiring in the brain there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's all trained. It's all trained. I would have been like, stop jerking off on the playground if I hadn't been trained.
You do that again, we're going to put your hands on the stove.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It makes sense. He was raised Catholic, so.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I understand.
Uh-huh. Were you raised Catholic?
Not really. I went to a Catholic church a few times, but my parents were divorced, not from each other, but like from previous marriages. So they were anti-Catholic church because of they weren't welcome.
Sure.
So I got bombarded with a lot of different stuff. Mm. Like there was Jehovah's Witnesses around for a while. I think it was my dad was on a spiritual journey, so I just kind of picked up whatever.
Whatever crumbs he left.
Yeah, yeah, whatever he was going through.
I'll follow your path.
I think more whatever chicken heads he left.
Right? Santeria, too. Oh, but that was like, yeah, the whole nine. So to me, I don't care. I came up with my own ideas and then I just go with that.
Sure.
I don't like a lot of the groupthink stuff. I'm not really drawn to.
No, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I just always find it interesting because,
I don't have that guilt, though. I have plenty of guilt, but it's not from that. It's just from their upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of guilt. So I got inherited some of it, but not to like the degree where my behavior is completely...
She's pointed at me.
Do you do things out of guilt?
Oh, yeah. That's the only thing I understand.
Oh, it's your main motivator.
Yes, my main motivator.
Uh-huh.
Guilt and anger are the two things I really understand.
Well, that sounds good.
What's yours? What are your main motivators?
I don't remember anymore. I there's a thing that happened in stand-up comedy that I fell into the pit that so many people fell into, which is I was raised to kind of look at a system and figure out my way up the ladder.
Yeah, for sure.
So I was able to do that with school, and I was able to do that with like the Boy Scouts of America.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, you just fulfill these requirements and then you go to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that makes sense. I can do that.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I'm at the top. Look at me. I made it to the top. Everybody celebrates me. I got the award. Mm-hmm. Hooray.
Yeah.
So
were you an Eagle Scout?
I was.
Wow.
Yeah. I brought that mentality into stand-up comedy.
Oof.
Which was it just doesn't work.
Nope.
Because it's not the same kind of structured functioning system.
Well, that's the thing. It
there is no
first.
Function.
At first,
at
yeah.
At first, you can recognize
for
it,
sure.
Break it down. You go, oh, I do the open mics.
I do all the open mics.
I get invited to other shows, and then I get in at the clubs, and then I start... the MC thing, and then I can bump up to feature, and then I can bump up to headliner, and then eventually you do a spot on Comedy Central, and then you do a half hour special on Comedy Central.
Uh-huh.
The problem was at that point, then what?
Yeah.
Did you do a half hour?
Yeah. And then my life fell apart. Just fell apart. Because I had no clue what the fuck was next.
Yeah, there wasn't.
Right.
And there's no next step on the ladder. It's you
that's
climbed...
when it's like it becomes this smoke,
right.
This huge smoke forever, and everybody just tries to navigate through it.
Yeah, it wasn't that I climbed a ladder. It's that I climbed out of a pit, and then I'm just like looking around in all directions, going, "Well, now which way do I walk?"
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so I just out of like confusion and like, well, did I do everything for nothing?
Yep.
Like, what? I don't even know what's next. And you talk to people in this industry,
yep,
and they look at you and go, well, what's next? Because managers, agents, they right. don't know.
They don't know either.
Producers have no idea.
Nothing.
Like, and the best thing that can happen in Los Angeles is you get on stage at the Improv and all of the most important people in Hollywood see you. And what it gets you is a meeting where they say, great, what else?
What do you got?
Mm-hmm. And you go, I don't know what else.
I was hoping you were going to guide me.
10 years to develop what I developed.
Just did, yeah.
I thought maybe you had something in mind for me.
Yeah. Right.
Since I did all of that previous work.
Right.
And because there were no answers anywhere, I just fell into this thing of like, fuck, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's the motivator? Like, you really have to like go back and find some sort of internal motivation to mm-hmm. be like, well, what else would I be doing with my time?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really always liked writing and telling jokes. So what am I working on now and how come? Mm-hmm. And do I like it? And you just magically start creating more stuff based on that, or
right.
you don't. And I had like 3 or 4 years in there of just confusion and drinking and just well, I guess I'll go do a set and then hang out with my friends because you need community, right?
For sure.
And then it's like, no, now you're just drunk.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now you're just drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, it just got what are the motivators? I was up for a game show. Actually, I got hired to do a game show, did the contract, did everything. And then they had a meeting. They're like, do we like the show? And everybody in the boardroom went, yeah, we do. And they said, do we like Ryan? They said, yeah, we do. And then one little frail hand went up and went, you know, we have a lot of white guys hosting game shows right now. Maybe we get a woman for this one. And everybody just nodded their heads and went, all right, well, let's start looking for talent. And that was it for me. Like, they just threw my contract out the window and it was done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I had to, you know, that's a kind of a kick in the teeth
yep.
to be like, well, you're abandoning me for this talent that you don't even know exists yet. You have to go find it.
Right.
And, you know, to throw me a real person away.
Even at least to give you the first season just to as a test trial.
Well, I mean, we had already shot a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, clearly they liked me enough to give me the pilot.
Right.
But then I had to like go back to the drawing board. It was like, well, did I really come to LA to do a stupid game show?
Right. Not at all.
For not even that much money.
Yeah.
In the hope of getting exposure so I could do stand up. No, that's not what was. So let's go back to square one. What are we doing here?
Mm-hmm.
And like developing kind of an internal support system.
Yeah.
But what are the motivators? I don't know. It's just curiosity, I think, is a big one.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the main one that I'm trying not to be a piece of shit and focus on.
Because mm-hmm.
certainly depression can be one. Like,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Well, maybe if we work hard enough, we'll feel better.
Yeah. Huh?
Right. Yeah.
Come on.
And I did that for a long time, and it doesn't work.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't work at all.
Well, that's the whole thing where you put these things on pedestals and then achieving them, and then you're like, oh.
Yeah.
I feel exactly the same as before.
It's that
Prince, besides the rush.
That Prince quote mm-hmm. that he was like, I've been to the top of the mountain and there was nothing there.
Yeah.
And you go, ugh.
And then he died from fentanyl.
Yeah. 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 Where are you trying to get to with these pills, Prince?
Yeah.
So curiosity, you find so many people who are just motivated by money.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's their main
I wish
motivator.
I had that, man. I wish I had that.
Well, because it's gross. Like from the outside, it looks so gross.
Yes, mm-hmm. it does.
But it's, I almost think of it that they're, instead of people who are hoarders, that they fill their home with stuff, that they just have that impulse when they're out, they see something, you know, I can imagine myself needing this one day, so I'm going to buy it.
Yeah.
And then they end up buying everything and going into debt and filling their home.
Yep.
I imagine it's that hoarder mentality,
same
but
thing
it's
with money.
Money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's what people like.
I could need this money one day, so I need to stockpile it.
Look, I think Mark Cuban is waking up every day going, well, how do I get more money?
Yeah, he definitely is.
How do I do that?
Yeah.
Because I just need more of it.
By the way, very comedian way of saying that, waking up every day.
Uh-huh.
He's waking up every morning.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I divide it. See, this is another thing I'm trying to avoid. You shouldn't cut things into two. Shouldn't be day and night. It shouldn't be us and them.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be Democrats and Republicans. You shouldn't cut things into two. You should look at the overlap. Mm-hmm. Morning would be part of that overlap.
Yep.
But no. Morning, afternoon, evening, dusk.
Yep.
There's too many.
The idea of a day just disgusted you. Day.
Well, now that I have a dog, I wake up at 9:30 every day, 9 every day, and walk him.
Mm-hmm.
I take him out at 9.
How's Is there that? Anything you don't like about having a dog?
Fucking everything. Are you kidding? God, it's exhausting. And he just follows me around. He'll be right here where he is. He's asleep on the couch next to us.
He's a gorgeous
and
little
if
puppy.
I get up and I go take a piss, he will wake up from his nap and go, nah, I should go into the toilet with him. I should really follow him in there.
I should probably go see what he's up
just to. Just to lay on the bath mat. Yep. Just to hang out. And he just follows me everywhere. I have to walk him at 9 and 1 and 5 and 9 and 1 a.m. You piece of shit. You constantly have to empty yourself. You won't let me clean your ears. I'm just talking to the dog right now.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're listening, I'm just berating him.
He is a puppy still, right? Is he chewing stuff?
He's about 10 months old. He was never much of a chewer.
Is he a shedder?
A little bit. Not too much, though.
Sounds like you got an easy dog.
We do have an easy dog. I was informed that at 6 a.m. he could start barking at me because he wants to go out. And I was like, oh, that would be unacceptable.
Yeah. Not in this house.
Owner surrender. Where is the local shelter?
Yeah.
And we got him from a shelter. And, you know, those shelter dogs. We were looking at dogs for a little while. And there was this one dog. It was so timid. And it really liked my girlfriend. But when I would talk, it would cower. Like it had just something against
right.
It had been abused or
something. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at the shelter, it had gone behind the counter and I'm trying to like call its name and it just had its back to me and then it just shoved its face between some binders and a bookshelf.
Oh my God.
And it's just like, it's just burying itself away from me. And I said, you know, that dog seems like it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm built for that. And here I am, one of the easiest dogs ever.
Yeah.
And I'm just like resentful as fuck of this little guy. Oh, you're so difficult.
Well, you get unconditional love, though. You can't even
It's very conditional. He's got to feed it.
Yeah. There's a condition.
I don't know, but
I've got to clean
I don't
his
think
ears.
Unconditional
he won't
love
let
exists
me.
In any capacity.
No?
Well, that's Catholicism. that's terrible. Jesus Christ. I have a great relationship with my father. I don't believe unconditional love exists.
What else don't you
I
like,
I don't
Ryan?
Think those are contradictory at
what
all.
What don't I like? Oh, you had me make a list. You know, you guys were going to come last time, and then you got in your car accident,
yep.
And you guys couldn't make... And I had a whole charcuterie plate set up with meats.
Did you really?
And nice,
I'm so sorry.
Nice no, I didn't. I didn't fucking prepare for you guys. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I love the idea of a podcast where you complain about things, and then you just get somebody on, and they're like, oh, the subway in Paris is just so dirty. Isn't it dirty?
It really is, though.
It's such a quaint outing to be in Paris, and there's so many nice cafes. And then you go into the metro, and it's just filthy.
Paris is filthy. Yeah. Don't you hate how in Paris at 5 in the morning, the whole town smells like freshly cooked bread? It's disgusting.
I don't have a sense of smell. So
you don't?
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah.
Dude, my best friend doesn't have a sense of smell.
Really?
It was from a reaction to a medicine that she was given when she was a kid.
Oh, how old?
She was, I think, like 6 or 7.
Okay. Because that's what doctors, that was the first thing out of a doctor's mouth when I told him I couldn't smell. He was like, yeah, maybe you were given medication as a baby and you had a bad response. And yeah, what can you do?
Yeah, it was that simple. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they don't know why you don't have a sense of smell?
I never really got into having it checked out because there are so many things. Like it could be something in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
It could be the neurons going from my brain down into my nose. It could be something in my nose. It could be. And to do all the tests just to find out, well, here's why you can't smell. I'm like, yeah, I don't need to do that.
Yeah.
Like who cares?
Does it fuck with your taste?
Yeah. Taste is 80% smell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So technically, I only have like 3.2 senses.
Wow.
That's only 0.2 more than Helen Keller.
Wow.
But somehow she's the miracle worker. And nobody gives a shit about my disability.
That's a really
nobody
good point.
Nobody gives a shit.
Well, nobody gives a shit about that disability in general because they can't see it.
Right.
You know?
They don't know how... Well,
they can't visualize you not being able...
And in Hollywood right now, there's so much, you know, people want diversity and they want it in all different factions. And I go in and I go, I can't smell. And they go, yeah, we don't know how to exploit that. So
yeah,
we don't care about your disability if we can't exploit it.
Dude, you would have crushed it on Fear Factor.
Yeah, well, there's a texture thing involved, though.
Yeah, but you like, could have ate all that shit.
When you can't smell, you learn to taste via texture. And like a cow eyeball, like there's just too much. There's a big mental leap there that I can't do.
All right, never mind then.
Yeah. But
I don't know how to exploit you.
Were you serious that the smell of Paris?
Yeah, yeah, 5 a.m. It just smells like bread everywhere. I actually really like it, though.
Oh, you enjoy it. I were being sarcastic.
Yeah, I was being sarcastic.
Using sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I was trying to go
not
with
knowing,
you.
Knowing, I'm sitting here going, well, I thought baked bread was a good smell.
Yeah.
From
yeah,
what
yeah.
I've observed, people seem to like
it. They like it. Yeah.
I was going with you with the unreasonable complaints. Is where I was going with you on that. Don't you hate when you're on a 5 a.m. stroll with the love of your life and you just made love in a beautiful mental health park in Paris? You know, Paris is covered in these beautiful parks because they had a suicide issue in the late 1800s, like a massive suicide issue.
Oh.
So they built all these beautiful parks all over.
See, you don't
the
kill
city.
Yourself. Look how pretty
didn't
this is.
Help.
Nope.
It didn't help, did it?
No, it did not help.
Okay, of course. But, I mean, what a weird politician idea to be like, well, people are killing themselves.
What if there's more trees and benches?
I mean, this is the Navy let 'em eat cake nation.
Yeah.
This is that's who they are.
Right.
They don't address the real problem, which is that they're just bad people and they should be killing themselves.
Well, there is a thing called... there was a book written called Mindset. It's by a PhD. She works at Stanford. Her name is Carol Dweck, and she wrote this book in the 70s called Mindset. And what she found was if you have a bunch of kids and you have them do a puzzle, and the kid does the puzzle, and then you tell him, hey, you're a really great puzzle solver.
You're not supposed to
do that.
Do
you want to try a harder one? And that, and of course, you know, you've had child training.
I
you're
went
like,
to
yeah, that's
for
a
this.
Bad idea. Yeah. the kid has it in their mind. They're like, oh, I'm a good puzzle solver.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of my identity now.
Yep.
Yeah.
So if I try a harder puzzle, what happens if I can't solve it? Does that mean I'm not a good puzzle solver?
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to this like conflict of identity. Whereas if you just tell a kid, hey, do you want to do this puzzle? And they do it and you go, huh, you did it. How'd you do that? They tell you, well, this is what I tried. And then you go, do you want to try a harder one? They go, yeah, I'll try a harder one.
Yeah.
And you go, how'd you do that? And they go, I don't know. I figured it out. Well, this one's really hard. Almost nobody solves it, but you could try it if you want. I love a challenge. And they like attack it.
Oh.
I think there's something about like the French population that for a long time they were given like a certain identity.
Yeah, they haven't contributed
and
shit.
And they have to like live up to it.
Yeah.
And anytime they don't, they feel bad about themselves. And you go, ugh. Yeah. But the mindset thing, it was divided up into a fixed mindset, which is you're a good puzzle solver, and a growth mindset of like, hey, do you want to try this? And the people.
Well,
because
if you're already like, if you already get the accolades of you being good at something, it also doesn't encourage you as much to want to grow.
Well, it creates anxiety.
Yeah.
It creates like you don't want to spoil your reputation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why like when you're anytime you're talking about a kid's art, the best question you can ask them is, what is this?
Yeah.
And they explain the art and you go, oh, I see that. That's the kind of way you want to talk about their art so that they don't feel pressure to create a masterpiece every time.
Yeah.
There's so many ways to just make an anxious person.
And the French, I think, did a lot of them. I think they did a lot of
them. They did all of it.
And then they killed themselves.
Yep.
Like people often wonder like why the suicide rate of white men in America is so high.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, because you gave them this mindset that if they worked really hard... and they just worked and did well in life,
yep.
that they would be able to succeed. And for a lot of them, it wasn't true.
It's not possible.
And they were always told it was true.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they're like, well, I don't see any hope in the future, so I might as well not be here.
Yep.
And then they're gone.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of them being whiny. It's
no.
not a matter of them going, this used to be my country, and it's not that. It's them going,
empty
well,
promises.
I had a mindset and I can't get my way out of this hole. And so I guess I just won't stay.
Yep.
Bye.
It's actually kind of polite if you think about it.
To kill yourself?
Well, I mean, if you think, well, like, I don't serve a purpose anymore.
Yeah.
I'm going to take myself out of it. Like, that's a really, like, in a societal sense, that's a very polite way of being, like, instead of being like, I'm going to take.
It's if you have, like, a wife and kids, I don't think that's polite.
I'm talking about on a societal level, not on an interpersonal level.
Yeah.
On a societal level, if you feel like
an interpersonal level.
Why?
I don't think you can be polite to society. I don't think that really helps.
If you don't think you're contributing anymore to society and you internalize that and then you leave.
There. I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
I see what you're saying, that there is kind of a, I'm going to do society a favor. Mm-hmm. If I can't contribute,
right.
I don't see how I'll leave.
I can't succeed. I don't see a way of me doing it. There's no point in
me
staying.
So you send three bitter children into the world, and that, what's that effect on society?
Well,
then they try harder. I mean, everybody with dead parents tries harder.
I see what you're saying, too, uh-huh. because, you know, being polite on a societal level, I think, is impossible.
Yes.
You can do things that you think are positive for society, but
for
being
sure.
polite to society doesn't work.
But, no, it's interpersonal.
The idea that... Yeah, interpersonal comes into, like, when there's kids and family. I think the real polite thing to do to society would be, well, I've failed so far with this bullshit mindset of mine. Maybe I should reconsider how I'm going about things. And maybe I should maybe try something new and be curious and develop new skills.
Right.
And hang out mm-hmm. and try to bear a load and be responsible for something. I think that would probably
is that why you got the dog?
Society a lot more than killing yourself.
Yeah. Is that why you got the dog?
This is a rescue dog, everybody, so I'm helping.
Yeah,
I'm
helping. Not only being polite to society, but you're taking responsibility for something.
Yeah,
you're bearing a load.
You're keeping a thing alive.
This thing was going to be at a shelter for a little while, and I decided, no, you can be sheltered at my place.
Yep.
I'll take you on. I'll give you a life.
Ugh. Yeah, that adult mindset, though, I mean... Because I live in LA, I've done a lot of catering, and I lived in the Bay Area. I've been to a lot of tech companies, and I've just seen how everything is based around childhood now. There's pinball machines and arcade games and cornhole and like kombucha on tap, and like everything is casual. Uh-huh. And I just think there's like this return to childhood.
Almost like an elongated childhood.
I don't think it is. I think these are the people who have that mindset that they need to like identify a scaffolding and like climb up it and take over. And so they never really had a childhood because they were Eagle Scouts and Honor Society.
Oh, yeah.
And but you just see this.
But there's
like,
also like a lot of really young people that work there, like people in their 20s and stuff like that. So they're also... They're making these people's childhood longer, where they're not. That's
but I'm
why
saying
I mean,
these people never really had. They never really played cornhole growing up because they were doing homework and all this stuff. But it's just a rejection of response. Like that, nobody likes to appear responsible for.
Well,
anything.
I think kind of the point you're making is they climbed this ladder and they uh-huh. climbed it so fast and they did what I did. They thought, well,
exactly.
once I get to the top, things will be better. And every time they got it to a new level, things weren't better. So they're like, well, maybe I should bring back pinball because I never really got to do that.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
Maybe we put cornhole in the office. Would that give our lives meaning? And you go, no, that won't give your lives meaning.
No, it won't.
And I think one fascinating idea in our society especially is I think women figure that shit out a lot faster than men do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
But that causes a severe discord later, which is, you know, you think of a profession like law. Like there are women who are just killers in high school mm-hmm. and then they get to college and they slaughter it and then they go to law school and then they're top of their class and they get into a law firm. And by the time they're 35, they're a partner and they look around and they go, this fucking sucks.
Yeah.
This sucks. This is not giving my life meaning. I don't want to take a phone call from Australia at 3 a.m. on a Saturday because my client has a problem and they need it fixed now. I don't want to live like this. And so then women at 35 get out of law and search for things that would give their lives meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you have? You have all these male white lawyers.
Yeah.
And then you've got women going, well, how come there aren't more female lawyers? And you go, well, there were. They got smart and went looking for meaning in
they're
life.
All females.
didn't attach their meaning to their job.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
these dudes are miserable.
They're all Eddie Murphy.
And they're all at the
so
top of their
more
profession.
More men need to eat, pray, love is what you're saying, you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. Yeah.
That's why you guys have midlife crises is because 100%. It's a crisis to you. It's a journey for us.
Well, and you recognize the problem sooner.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
So
it becomes
not,
a journey for us
right, it's
before
not,
it's a crisis.
Before it's a crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't realize the problem till we're like 50, 55, and then mm-hmm. we see no way out, and then it's like, well, I should kill myself. Yeah. I should just somebody else will watch over the corporation.
Yeah, they'll figure it out.
My son-in-law will make partner. Things will be fine without me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I'll kill myself slowly with red meat.
And, or booze.
And booze. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Dude, have you ever read the stats for alcoholism and cocaine addiction in law firms? It's unreal. It's like they're living the same
life. Well, you can
also
afford it then.
Yeah, but you also need the distractions and you need the meaning that cocaine can give you for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you feel important on cocaine.
Yeah, you really do.
That's for sure.
Oh. But I still also think a lot of these tech companies and stuff like that, they do all of this stuff to because they get kids right out of college and they make it seem like it's still a youthful, fun environment while they suck all of the life out of those kids. And they don't learn all of these skills. That's why there's classes to teach you how to be an adult. There's so many. It is for like millennials. It's a huge thing. In millennials, yeah. It's like a big thing because like so many people in their 20s and even my age in their early 30s, they don't know how to sew. They don't know how to cook for themselves. They don't know how any of these basic survival skills on their own type of things.
Are the same way. I was doing a show at Flappers like a year ago and somebody had a flat tire and I changed the tire for them. Jeez. I had a circle of comics around me going, holy shit.
Yeah.
All I did was change a tire.
All you did is pull the jack out of the trunk and put it.
It's like three basic steps.
Crowd of comics were like, how do you know how to, did you learn this in the Army? I'm like, no, this isn't what I learned in the Army.
And you know what's crazy too? 100% of those people could pull up a YouTube video on their phone of how to change a tire and just follow the steps one at a time.
Yep.
And they could do it, but they won't do that either.
No.
And I had that growing up, like, my grandfather built his own house, you know, top to bottom with his own hands. You know, after World War II, he came back and he was like, well, should build a house and, you know, have a family in it. and because he did that, my dad, I watched my dad the whole time I was growing up. Something would break. He would fix it. You know, the toilet doesn't work. He's like, well, I should go buy this part at a Home Depot and then go do it. Rather than calling a goddamn plumber who you don't know when they're going to get there.
Yep.
And then they
and
come
how they're going
to
overcharge you, too.
They're going to put in an $8 piece that they're going to charge you $35 for. And then they're going to charge you for labor. And then, you know, who the hell?
$300 later.
Yeah.
You got a toilet that you could have fixed for $8.
$8. And watching my dad fix shit grow up, I was just taught like, oh, you have to try. You have to do it.
And if you can't do it, then you hire somebody.
Right, right, right.
And you make them show you how to do it. My dad always made the maintenance. If he couldn't fix something, he made him show him how he did it.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. But and they used to have books that they would have to look this stuff up in.
Yeah.
My dad looked up toilet in the encyclopedia just to figure out
how
does this work and what could be broken.
Yeah, every dude had, like, my dad had stacks of those chiffon books for every, all these different kind of cars that he owned,
because
you would have to, like, look it up and see how it works and how you could fix it and all that stuff and what parts you needed. So it was just, it was an encyclopedia for just another, you know, another thing.
Well, Time Life had those books.
I know, those Time Life
Robert Schimmel had that great joke about Time Life Volume 3, fixing the garbage disposal. Yeah, then I need Volume 4, learning to eat with a hook.
That's awesome.
That guy. Dude, great job quoting Robert Schimmel. Nobody talks about that.
Nobody does. He's so
that
funny.
That was a Tell's obsession.
Oh, my God.
David Tell says he's the greatest comic.
He was such a curmudgeon. Like he developed this character where nothing ever worked out for him ever. And he was the first guy I remember. I saw him on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He was paneling. And I watched, I don't remember what year it was, but I was a teenager. And I remember I stood there in my living room watching the interview. And then I got in the car and went and bought his albums.
Wow.
Like it was that quick. I was like, this is the greatest comic I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I'm going to go see what else he has. And you know where he recorded his first two albums?
Acme.
Cobbs in San Francisco.
Cobbs. Oh, okay.
The old Cobbs at the Cannery.
Yeah, yeah, the old Cobbs.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's funny. I think Richard Jenny and Robert Schimmel are two of the forgotten greats that like young people don't even talk about.
For sure. When Richard Jenny killed himself. Good,
yes, he
good
did.
Tie-in.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the reason was because he was great at stand-up. And it's terrible to be great at something and then have the industry go, eh.
And we can't use you.
And he's like, but when do I get the thing?
Yep.
But I do this good, though.
He didn't have the Prince mentality of like, give you what thing?
Yeah.
What thing is going to make you feel better?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're already doing the thing.
Even his suicide was a little funny too, because he his girl
go on
his girl. Oh, this is how I read about it. I don't know if this is 100% true, but his girlfriend said they were. I think they were downstairs, and she said, "I'm making breakfast." And he goes, "Okay, I'm gonna go get dressed, and I'll be right back down to eat." And then he went upstairs, and she heard a gunshot.
Ah, that is very good.
There had to have been a second where she was like, was it my cooking?
I'm making breakfast was the last thing I said to him.
Boom. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
That's great.
Funny to the last minute. But like, any you think about this guy, and I shouldn't even say this because this was somebody else's conversation that I was listening to, somebody talking about him, but it's really interesting about Richard Jenny. One of his best bits ever was about Jaws 3. Mm-hmm. And he said it came on in the bit. He says it came on at like 3 a.m. or whatever. And it's a great bit about breaking down Jaws 3. And I don't remember who I was listening to talk about this. It was on the radio or something. And they were like, no shit, that guy killed himself. He was watching Jaws 3 at 3 a.m. and writing a genius bit about breaking down Jaws 3 at 3 a.m. The guy was tortured.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You don't think about the mentality. Like, it's a silly, clean bit.
Right.
But that's coming from a weird place.
Yeah. And I feel bad because I have a bit about the original Poltergeist that I wrote at 3 a.m. that people really seem to enjoy.
Are you okay, Ryan?
People seem to enjoy. Listen,
I'm really glad you got a puppy.
I was drinking back then.
You know
guys.
What? I'm just going to go to the kitchen and make you some breakfast and we'll feel better.
Call back. What else don't you like?
I don't know if you knew that about me. I stopped drinking a couple of years ago.
I didn't know.
Just because I felt old and tired.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that...
I like that you didn't make a production out of it.
Well, it wasn't so much that I thought I was an alcoholic or that my life was spiraling out of control. Mm-hmm. I really felt tired. And I really felt
the depressant part was really taking its toll.
Yeah, You're 33 and you're writing a bit about Poltergeist, maybe.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. And so it was just one of those things where it was like, oh, maybe now's a good time to stop. And as you like look around, you realize like, oh, there are a lot of comics that stop in their mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm in the middle of stopping. Yeah. I stopped for 40 days. I'm like, it's a relationship I can't get out of right now. But like, I'm like, I drink like 90% less than I drank ever in my adult life.
Of course, of course. Yeah. Well, and I think if I were to ever drink again, it would be severely less.
Oh, for sure.
Part of the reason I don't drink at all is because my girlfriend doesn't drink. So
that's nice.
It helps.
I think if I ever like had a drink and she saw me, she'd be like, what's going on, buddy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is everything okay? You having some medicine for some reason?
Yeah.
Right.
Is the puppy a little much?
Yeah.
You're real tired of him following you, aren't you?
I'm trying to get my alcohol taste above my income level so that it's just
something to strive for.
Yeah. It's like a nice thing. Like my friend was working, he was DJing at Checker Hall in Highland Park, which is a bougie place. And he gave me, you know, a drink coin or whatever. Why can't I say that? I've been using those my whole life. What am I talking about?
A drink ticket?
A drink ticket.
Voucher?
Yeah, a drink ticket, but it was like a nice coin. Mm. And I got like a fucking old-fashioned with a real one with an egg white in it and stuff. And I'm like, this is how I'm going to save my drinking. I'm just going to... Just stuff I can't afford on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
No more Bud Light.
That was supposed to be the whole thing. It was supposed to be a luxury thing.
Yeah, I got a nice little liquor cabinet going right now.
That was the whole thing. Is like, oh, I got. That's why I was like, oh, I got this fucking 12-year. You guys want? It was supposed to be like a luxury. That was the whole thing. It was like a rich people.
We've got a cooler full of Pabst.
Yeah,
you
guys
drink 19 Pabst.
Yeah.
I got a tall can of Steel Reserve, but you have to drink it before it warms up 1 degree more than it is now. It has to be 1 degree from frozen.
You have to slam it. Yeah.
Yeah, we took the drinking a little too far as a country. I think we took the pills a little too far as a country.
Mm-hmm.
We got sidetracked real bad, and I think it was that mindset thing.
Yep.
Well, I think it was luxury turned into distraction, which turned into an excuse to not realize what's happening.
Yeah.
We got
promised a rose garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, somewhere somewhere along the line, the media and all of our culture just started telling Americans, like, have a good time. Mm-hmm. Have a good time. Have a good time. Have a good time. And that's all we do.
Yeah. Like, instead of a pursuit of happiness, it's just pursuit of a good time. Pursuit of fun.
Yeah.
As opposed to...
Are you not having a good time? You should probably take these pills because you're probably depressed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We can change your brain
chemistry.
Do you ever
feel like things are hard and you're bummed out? Meds.
That's no way to live.
Yeah. Mm-mm. It should be fun all the time.
You should be cornholing and ping-ponging as much as possible.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You cut your knuckles on the air hockey table, we'll give you some Percocets. Don't worry about it.
It'll be easy. Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think work is too difficult? Yeah, it's probably illegal what they're doing to you. You should have a lawsuit. Okay. All right. And I think there was a time in America where everybody just looked at each other and said, work sucks. And other Americans go, yeah, work sucks. It's terrible.
But that's the thing, it's always sucked.
Yeah. We all agreed that work sucked. And then we're like, yeah, but you do the hard, awful work so that you can do better stuff when you're not at
work.
And then it just became, no. Just get a job that you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
And also,
which is a lie, which is a complete and utter fucking lie, though.
Well, and by the way, anytime you don't like anything at work, you go, well, I must not love my job.
Yeah.
It's this either or mindset. Yeah, either you love it or you don't, and those are the only options.
Well, also,
it's either day or night. Those are the only.
Those fucking, like, especially with the moving to a tech industry, like, they shuttle you to work in a bus with Wi-Fi. They have a daycare at the place. They have, like, a preschool at a lot of these Google and Facebook.
They have apartments there where you can just stay.
So
you
just could work 24/7. There's no reason not to be working.
They feed you all
day
long. You could never leave the work. You could never leave the place.
Yeah, you're like a $100,000 a year slave.
Yeah.
It's fucking brutal.
And that's what I'm talking about is, like, I think a lot of times it's the illusion that you have all of this cool shit, this childhood that's happening, but it's not really. They're just keeping you chained to a place that you work.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you've got a segment of Americans who look up to it.
Yeah.
Because they're like, but they make $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
I'm working at Arby's. I don't make I want a better job.
That's why you work that job for 3 years and you quit. You save up as much money as possible. You live as cheap as possible. And then
good
you
luck
quit
trying
you
to
travel.
Quit. You don't think they're going to just let you go that easy?
You can quit. You're not really enslaved to them.
But well, you are because you developed a booze addiction. You're drinking a lot of Steel Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And you're not really working on your goals. Mm-hmm.
That's been the fight for the 8-hour workday back in the turn of the century, the labor movement. It was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for recreation. Mm-hmm. That's what you're supposed to have.
888.
888. But
yeah, people are very unhappy right now. Like, I think there's one thing we should have, and this is one of the things you told me to write down things I'm upset about,
mm-hmm.
and the word, just the word gratitude is one of them, because I was in the UK. I was eating at a pub,
mm-hmm.
and I ordered a chicken sandwich, and the server came over, put down a cheeseburger, and said, "There you go." And I went, I ordered a chicken sandwich. And she said, yeah, that's what they gave me. And she walked away. And that was it. And by the way, she doesn't care. You know why? Because they don't tip in the UK. They're
yeah.
right,
tipping.
No.
Whereas here in the US, you order a chicken sandwich. They bring you a cheeseburger. You say, I ordered a chicken sandwich. What does the server say? Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I'll get that fixed for you right away.
Because they want those $3.
Yeah,
and then within moments, you have what you ordered.
Yep.
And what do Americans do? They go home and they write a Yelp review. They got my order wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they did everything they could to fix it. Oh, mm-hmm. my God.
Yeah.
But people
spoiled.
Are so, yeah, we want it perfect all the time right away. Meanwhile, they have no idea that in another country, holy shit, you're not getting anything you want.
No. Mm-hmm.
My new favorite thing is, and I've been trying to like explain this to audiences and it's going nowhere, but all of us, like just thinking about American privilege, you have the instinct, if the elevator doors are closing and you want to catch that elevator, you put your hand into the metal device.
Mm-hmm. These
and
huge,
you know,
two things closing.
You just believe.
Subways, too.
It's going to stop for me.
Mm-hmm.
The machine will stop for me. I'm an American. machines can't hurt me. A machine can't hurt a human. I read that. I'm sure it's true.
Even saws, once it senses moisture, it stops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, if you were in like one of the lower nations in the world and there's an elevator, if you went to put your hand in there, people would gasp. They'd go, "What are you doing?" And Americans would be like, "Well, there's sensors. And the machine isn't supposed to." And they're going, "What are you fucking talking about?
Why do you trust this cold piece of metal?"
Yeah.
We don't know what's true in your country, but yeah, we have never even heard of that.
Yeah.
But do we have gratitude for it? No, we just expect it to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And we expect to be taken care of. And what's weird is there are even like hardcore conservative Republicans who talk about a nanny state, but they shove their hand in the elevator every single time.
Absolutely.
And if the elevator were to hurt them, they would go, "Well, I need to sue. I need to sue the elevator operator for not protecting me." Meanwhile, they're the same conservative Republicans that go, "We're over-lawyered in this country."
Yep.
And you go, no, you can't, you can't say it's a nanny state and that we're over-lawyered and shove your hand in the goddamn elevator. You can't do all of them.
You also can't complain about political correctness and then try to get Michelle Wolf killed for telling jokes.
Right.
It's the same thing.
All day after the White House correspondence dinner. What's weird is it's non-offended Republicans calling offended Republicans snowflakes.
Yep.
You go, okay, you guys are cannibalizing your own party.
Which is good. It's about time they started doing it.
It's happening all the time.
Liberals have been doing it long enough. It's about time the Republicans started doing it to each other.
even the idea, we talked about trains a little bit.
Yep.
Like if you're in certain foreign countries and you have a train ticket, and the train's not there, and you go up to the booth and you go, I had a ticket for the 2 o'clock train. They're going to go, yeah. And you go, well, the train's not here. And they go, yeah, I noticed that.
That's it.
What do you want?
Go, well, when's it get here? They're going to go, how am I supposed to know?
Yeah, I'm not running the train.
The train, who knows? It could be here Tuesday. What do you want from me?
Yeah.
We don't have some perfect system that works every day of the year.
Well, and that's the thing,
unless
is we don't
Japan
even
or Germany.
In the US we don't either, but everybody still expects that, like, there's
the train's 3 minutes late and you go, well, this city is fucked.
Yeah. They want a perfect system when it's the system is created by humans, which aren't perfect because perfection doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So
the trains in this city is fucked because of the trains. Like, it doesn't go enough places. Look at the traffic. It's insane.
Oh, sure.
And I ride the train to work, and it breaks down so much. It's just like, man, L.A. is a little third world-ish. Like, the income gap is third world level, like, where we have...
Yeah, there's not enough middle class here.
We have rich people, poor people maxing out credit cards trying to pretend to be rich, and homeless people. That's basically what we have here. And the infrastructure is shit. Like, I one of my biggest things I worry about is a fucking, like, what would an earthquake actually look like in Los Angeles, like a big one? I haven't seen it. I wasn't here in 96 when it happened.
Right.
But the infrastructure here is shit.
Uh-huh.
It is shit. Oh, God.
Well, they've tried to make a lot of rules so that buildings don't fall down and power doesn't go out and water doesn't stop. But other than that,
that's about it.
You're going to have a lot of rich people in their homes going, well, why can't I get groceries delivered?
Yeah.
I don't understand what the thing is.
That's what the thing about living on top of hills and shit. It's like, ooh, you really trust that things are going to be convenient.
Well, it's the problem of not having those middle class jobs. I mean, that's what's happening in San Jose right now is... the police force can't afford to live there.
Right.
And yet they can't afford to house the police. And so the policemen and women are going, well, we're just going to move to a city where it's cheaper to live and we can kind of make the same money. And we'll go be police elsewhere. And then San Jose doesn't have police. And you go, well, this is fucked. Police, you're going to have a lot of crime.
Yep.
And then what are you going to do? Because the poor people
duly noted. So if you want to commit any crimes, guys, go to San Jose.
San Jose is where it's at. You will not get caught.
I can't remember who it was, but when the guy got murdered in front of the San Jose Improv, you remember that?
I seem to remember that. Yeah.
The newspaper had the comic's name on the marquee above the caution tape and stuff. I wish to God I could remember who it was.
I'm sure we can find that image on the internet. Fans of this podcast, you go find it for you.
Please do find it.
Yeah, email
it
to us. nosirpod@gmail.com.
I think that's a very strange thing that's happening now is like fans do work.
Yeah.
They do labor. Like, they create posters for people. Mm-hmm. They just yes. they want to like share information. They consider themselves like an entity of the thing. And I don't know if it's because we're so broken up as individuals in society that you want to feel like you're part of something.
Yeah.
So you go, well, I want to contribute. So they mention my name on the air. So that when I meet other fans of the podcast, other fans will be like, oh, you're the person that made
oh, you do that thing.
Intro.
Yeah, that's oh. cool. I've seen a podcast build an empire, like witnessed them build an empire.
Dude,
like
there's
that.
There's nothing like your mom's house with that shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your
yeah.
mom's house is has an army of people who just do so much for them.
Right. Right. And it's amazing. It's amazing. And all those people feel good when they I mean, when you think about a band. Like Zeppelin. People would go see Zeppelin, yeah. but the number of people who bonded in a bar going, oh, you love Zeppelin? I love Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. that's what you really want.
Yeah.
And that's what's really pissed me off about social media is the stupid, stupid Hollywood industry is like, well, you have to use social media to reach out to your fans. And you go, no. Social media isn't so that I can reach out to them. It's so that they can all talk about me. It's mm-hmm. so they can meet each other.
Yeah,
on my that's what
create
needs to
a
happen.
Community. That yeah. was yeah. the whole fucking point
right.
of it.
It's not so that I can just dictate to people what to right, do. Right, that's, right, right. That's the only way agents see money. Well, tell yeah. your fans to buy your thing. Well, tell your fans to go to the show. Like dictate, and you go. No, nah, they kind of do their own thing.
Yeah, they're human
yeah,
beings.
I'm not a dictator.
I'm glad to have them.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. I like them, and I don't really like you.
Yeah.
yeah. And then agents don't, I mean, they're very lazy, so they don't think beyond that.
Sure.
They just go, well, it works for Aziz. It works for this person. It works for that person. So I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
And you go, well, that's because you haven't bothered thinking about it. You made a list of all the ways that social media works for you.
Yeah.
And
right.
you didn't think about anything else in the world.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, just do a Louis thing. Just sell it on your website. You'll make millions.
And by the way, that was fascinating too, because very smart agents disliked that immensely.
Yeah.
You know why? Because they thought, oh no, we told all the talent DIY, do it yourself.
Now they don't
and
need us.
And that cut me out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I get my money? So then they had to do fancy Hollywood math and say, yeah, when Louis sold his own special on his website and made $1 million in one day, that was actually a complete failure, if you think about it.
Oh, my God.
And you
God.
Say, how so? And they go, well, he sold it for $5 a piece, so if he made $1 million, that's only, what, 2 million people? That's a 0.2 in the ratings. A 0.2 in the ratings is a flop. They're like, but if he would have sold the special
which he did a year later
to something else, he would have been able to reach a wider audience and make that money off of touring,
it's also
and he would
better
have made
to
more
least-
than a million, and you go... He made $1 million in one day, and
I've
you didn't
had,
get a cut.
Yeah, that's really what it problem. Is. You wanted your percentage.
Yeah.
But I've heard from more than one rich comedian that you should make your own thing and then lease it. You yeah. lease it to Comedy Central. You lease it to Showtime. You don't let them make it. You put up the money up front. You make it, and then you sell it to them.
Yeah.
Or lease it to them.
Yeah.
So then they pay for the usage, and then guess who gets all of the money? That's yeah. you. The yeah. artist does.
Right, right. And... I think there's a lot of...
Even fucking John Panette back in the day told me that.
If
yeah.
Louis' special was a flop, I would love for their fancy Hollywood math to tell me which one wasn't.
Sure. Well,
what special was bigger than his last five besides the most recent one?
Have you ever researched that phrase, Hollywood math? It's kind of fascinating.
Really?
Due to Hollywood math, the producers of Forrest Gump, one of the highest grossing films at that time ever... We're able to tell the writer, nah, we lost money on that film, actually. We can't pay you your points because of the way we calculated
wow.
foreign press and foreign royalties and things and shipping and handling and all that. We lost money, actually. And the writer's going, this is the biggest grossing movie.
And there's nothing you can say. You can't yell at any. You can't.
Well, I mean, there's big legal battles where fancy accountants. I mean, this is where forensic accounting started as a business. They go,
wow.
Well, how did you do the math on this?
Because mm-hmm.
doing math is if you fuck with it enough, you can get any result that
sure.
you want.
Sure, it's a religion.
I mean, if you take the same numbers and use the same symbols, you know, 4 plus 5 times 6 divided by 3, you use those same symbols and you go 3 divide yep. by 6 mm-hmm. times 5 plus 4, mm-hmm. you get vastly different numbers.
Yep.
And what they do is they say, well, we use the same numbers and symbols. Yeah, but you did it in the wrong order. Well, we did it in the right order for us.
Right.
So is this an ongoing battle from back in 1994? Like, did the Forrest Gump guy get paid?
I don't know if he got paid or not. Oh, my God. Somebody research that and let us know on Twitter.
Yeah, at No Sir Pod. Tweet us. Let us know.
Did anybody make money? Yeah, did the writer Forrest Gump end up making money? Did he work again?
Yeah.
I know I could Google this, but you guys could too.
And here's what's going to happen, everybody. They're going to retweet the answer.
For sure.
And then if you're a fan of the pod, you have to go and you have to like that tweet and you have to say a nice thing about the person who actually did the work.
That's great. And then we have a community.
You guys get to know each other as a group. And then you can let people just keep doing the work.
Speaking of social media, tell everybody where to find you.
I'm on Twitter at Stout Ryan, YouTube / Ryan Stout, Facebook / Ryan Stout, Instagram. I'm Stoutsider, Stoutsider.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of Ryan Stouts out there.
Is there?
And even though I was able to get in the game real early and grab a lot of web properties, new properties keep popping up.
Mm-hmm.
And since there's so many of us, it's really hurting my brand.
It's a wash.
Bummer.
Yeah. But I have RyanStout.com.
How to be an audience also. Buy his album.
Go buy that. Or listen to it on Spotify or Pandora. Like, whatever you do, those numbers go up.
Yep.
The only thing that hurts me, like, if you just don't do anything, if you go, fuck this guy.
Yeah, that's the only thing that,
that's the only thing that really. And by the way, don't even think that it hurts. It's a wash then. It just doesn't, you don't factor in to any of the math ever. Yeah. So if you don't want to count, don't look it up. If you want to count for something, interact in some way, go right ahead. Check out the first album, Touché. If you're in Minneapolis, I'm going to be there May 8th through 12th. So come out and see a show. I think I'm going to record a new album.
Ooh.
But the audience won't know that.
They won't know.
Yeah.
So you guys are already on the inside.
Yeah.
When you guys got insider info.
The last one actually was recorded in 2014.
Oh, okay. So you
and I didn't release it. But the way I write in my style, it doesn't really... It's not like I'm making political references or topical references. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is a joke that worked.
You don't
still
have a Jersey
works,
Shore bit?
And no.
Yeah. You do have a Poltergeist 1 bit, which is old enough that it's no longer even really...
Well, now it's retro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now...
comes back.
Now it's still relevant.
Do you remember that Richard Pryor bit where he talks about Poltergeist, where he's like, if it was a black family?
Yeah.
And he's like, bitch, get the cross out your pussy.
Yeah.
I love that one so much. That's one of the original, let me take a white scenario and put black people in it. That's like when that was like one of the originals of that.
Yeah. And it was, everything has been kind of a derivative from there.
Yep. Get out your bed, wash your ass, and get the cross out your pussy. We got company.
Ryan, thanks so much for being on.
No, thank you. We didn't even get to a lot of the things that I hate, but I think we got through a lot of them.
We did.
We got through a bunch.
It was good. It was fun.
We didn't even get to talk about policemen rolling through stop signs. Those motherfuckers.
Oh, that's called a California stop.
Well, that's when anybody does it. It's a California stop. But when the police do it, I mean, that's what leads to people getting shot.
It's true.
As soon as you think you can break the little laws, you think you can break the bigger ones. And as long as we can hold them accountable for the little stuff.
How you do anything is how you do everything.
Yeah. And as soon as you get that taste of power, I can roll through the stop sign.
Well, I've seen them turn on the siren and shit like that for that stuff too.
Yeah.
And I've also seen them play on fucking Facebook at a stoplight. And it's on a computer.
Right.
You're on a computer and you're going to tell me I can't text and drive? Get the fuck out of here.
I had training.
Yeah,
go
fuck yourself.
So I'm allowed to look at Facebook. Let's end there. Go fuck yourself.
Yep.
At No Sir Pod, follow us on all the assorted social media, tweet at us nosirpod@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.
No sir, I don't like it. No sir, I don't like it. No sir, I don't like it. No sir, I don't like it.
No sir, I don't like it. No sir, I don't like it.
No sir, I don't like it. No sir, I don't like it.
What the fucking matter? I'm a stupid one.
What is the fucking matter?
What is the fucking matter? What is the fucking matter? What is the fucking matter? What is the stupid one? your life. No, sir, I don't like it.
I don't want your life.
No, sir, I don't like it.
I don't want your life.
No, sir, I don't like it.
I don't want your life.
No, sir, I don't like it.
I don't want your life.